Well, hello everybody. We'll welcome you all back to our program. The topic for next week, can I thank you, hammer that glass again. The topic for next week is the politics of disability. How do we see people with disability? Are they fellow humans? Do we treat them with respect? The speaker will be Dr. Claudia Malacrida, and she's the author of several books, and she will be presenting this for us. So I think we'll now get back to today's topic, the conscientious objection to military service and citizenship, a Canadian perspective. So if we could have our speaker back up to the podium. Am I coming through? Good. We will now have the question period. So, if you have any questions, get up to the mic, and the speaker will hopefully be able to answer them for you.
Thank you very much for your talk. Is this on? Hello. It's shocking. I have a question, which maybe a little bit out of your purview. My name is Bev Mundell-Atherstone, and I'm wondering if you could comment on the difference between how Canada treated the conscientious objectors who came up from the U.S. during the Vietnam War versus how the treatment of the conscientious objectors now from the Iraq War in the U.S.
Well, that is a little bit outside of my area. I probably know something fairly similar to what you know from reading the newspapers and things like that. But it does seem to be a rather less tolerant attitude now, perhaps. I know there were a great many people. I don't know if there's any specific numbers available about how many people came to Canada as a protest against the Vietnam War, how many actually stayed for a long time. But it was a fairly significant number, and I think it really sort of affected the tone of Canadian politics in the later years. But right now, I'm not sure about what I think possibly public attitudes are still very similar, because wasn't it suggested in Parliament that that they ought to be allowed, people who came to Canada that were conscientious objectors from the war in Iraq, but the current administration sort of quashed that? I'm not totally up on that. But yeah, it does seem to be that there is something of a tradition in Canada that way, at least in the second half of this century. And it's a difficult sort of thing to try to figure out what our responsibility is as another country there. That's a kind of a rambling, I don't think it's really a clear answer, I'm sorry, but I think it is a very interesting thing to pay attention to. Yeah.
When you come up to the microphone, will you give us your name, please, as well as your question?
Yes, Albert Coy. Individual rights and minorities versus majority rights. That's today I'm talking about, because you did a very good job of bringing forth what happened in the past. I'm Albert Coy, by the way. And anyway, I'm just wondering, minority rights and individual rights, they just thought are coming to the point of being sometimes obnoxious. We're trying to bring their point across. Well, you hear these here, different things they do. They have these marches, and they get to the point of stepping over the law. But should there not be more rights for the majority? We find that out in so many places in our lives.
I don't know if I can really say what there should be, but I know it's really a difficult sort of a balancing act of trying to figure out what sort of freedoms and rights certain groups can have while still, you know, not impinging too much on majority rights. I think maybe Canada tends to have a little bit more of a strong focus on minority rights than, say, the United States, for example, which tends to focus on things in a little bit more of an individual way. Canada tends to look at people a little bit more in terms of groups. But, yeah, it is. It's a balancing act, and this is part of what the Canadian government was trying to figure out during the First World War. How much should we be forcing everyone to behave the same way and make this be, you know, truly democratic and fair, and how much do we have other obligations not to force our citizens to do something that they think is morally wrong? And it is. I think it's something that there isn't a clear answer to. I think you just have to keep being aware of it and trying to negotiate it and renegotiate it and trying to work out what's best at the time. That's clear.
Thank you. Another question I have for her. In regard to the quote from Scripture regarding loving your neighbor, mm-hmm. and also at this time of the year, peace on earth, goodwill to men, does this love thy neighbor come to the point of protecting your neighbor?
I think that's part of how people talked about it in the tribunals. One of the questions that conscientious objectors tended to be asked was, well, you say you're an objector, what would you do if a German came into this room right now and attacked your wife? Like, you'd go in, right? You'd defend them. And if the conscientious objector said, yes, I would go over and defend her, they were deemed to be not really an objector then, if they were against, you know, that. So it... Sorry, okay. But if they said that they wouldn't, they were deemed to be sort of probably a liar and a humbug. So this sense of portraying the war in that defensive way. Okay, yes.
Hi, my name's Ian McKenna. Are you hearing me okay? Good. That's just a speculative one. We now have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms mm-hmm. from 1982. And one part of that is freedom of conscience. And I'm just sort of interested in the sense of, and this would particularly apply to people who are escaping from other countries, you know, where they might be forced to do battle and so on. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered your opinion on that. Do you think that would meet the section one of the Charter challenge, you know, the one that says, well, the government can pass legislation that's necessary in a free and democratic society to override freedom of conscience. And I just wondered if you had an opinion on that. You don't need to. I don't, because I only just thought about it when you were talking mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
But I'd be really interested in hearing. And then I have to go, because I got an exam at 2 o'clock.
Okay, so it'll be really fast. So you're asking if the Charter of Rights, with its sort of clause about freedom of conscience, if that conscience, I don't know, it's hard not to say conscious, isn't it? If that sort of would override conscription, or if that would mean that refugees coming into Canada should be permitted to stay if they're coming on conscientious grounds?
Yeah, that would be the question, if they're here on conscientious grounds. And mm-hmm. that's what I would hope happened. But I just wondered if you'd, in the modern era, had any indication of that. I mean, usually, of course, the government can get rid of them, mm-hmm. you know, send them back. Mm-hmm. But that would be the question then, is that a breach of freedom of conscience? And
it seems to me as though it could be. I'm certainly not an expert on it at all, but I think a reasonable case could be made. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much. Okay. We'll see you later.
Okay.
My name is Eric Williams. I was really interested. Thank you very much for the talk. I found it very interesting. What I would like, however, is to know, rather more specifically, mm-hmm. the actual numbers of people involved.
So
how many soldiers were altogether enlisted from Canada, and how many conscientious objectors we allowed in the end, and how many cases were rejected in the end, and also the proportionality of the Quebec numbers as well.
a lot of these things I'd really like to know too. In terms of the number of people who enlisted, it's something very close to 500,000. This is what Robert Borden had pledged to send overseas, and by the end of the war, that was very close to what had happened. I think it was slightly over 500,000. In terms of the numbers of conscientious objectors, that's a lot more difficult to get at because Lyman Duff, the head of the Central Appeal Tribunals that I referred to, after the First World War, he burnt all the tribunal records. He was troubled by the fact that the tribunals in Quebec were harsh, and he thought that they were a living menace to national unity. And so he burned them all, which is something that I'm very angry at him for, but I'm working on it, which means that it's much more difficult to get at specific numbers. I've gone through and tried to figure out how many there were. It's not the main focus of my work. I'm sort of more interested in how they were perceived than exactly how many there were, but you do have to have some sense of how many people there were in order to try to get at that. And I've put forward some sort of a listing of who I found in newspapers and other sort of histories, but it's difficult as well because most of the people who the government intended to be exempted, the Mennonites and the Duke of Boys, don't generate a lot of paperwork. They don't have newspaper articles about people who didn't end up having to go to tribunals because they were accepted. So what I sort of tried to do when I was trying to estimate about how many conscientious objectors there might have been was I just sort of went to the 1911 census, and it did categorize people according to their religion, and I figured out how many men of military age would have belonged to those denominations that asked for exemption. So not just the Mennonites and Quakers, but also the International Bible Students and Seventh-day Adventists, and sort of got a rough estimate that way of about 25,000. It wouldn't be perfect, obviously, because some people would have got exemption on other grounds. A lot of Mennonites were farmers, for example, and would have gotten exemption as being a farmer. Some people did enlist, even though they were from historic peace churches, but also on the other hand, some members of the mainstream churches objected as well. So I have that as a very sort of vague number, as about 25,000. It's interesting. I'm just going to talk for a long time, okay? You guys don't really need to answer any more, ask any more questions, do you? It's interesting that that's actually a similar number to the number of conscientious objectors who were in England as well, and they caused a huge, huge fuss. So one of the things that I think is interesting about Canada is how quiet everybody was, and then sort of some things about that. Yeah. Okay.
My name is Van Christou. Thank you very much, Amy, for a really fascinating talk.
Thank you.
I think it points out that history is such an important mirror through which we see ourselves today, and it's such an important study that you made on the First World War for that reason. You mentioned in your talk the fact that Canada has, from the early days, attracted many conscientious objectors from other countries, and I think that although we were afraid for so many years of the terrible brain drain that was going on here in Canada, of people leaving to go to America and other places, that there was a reverse brain drain just because of that reason. Mm-hmm. And I'm mindful of our University of Lethbridge here and the number of marvelous professors that we received as a result of the objecting the Vietnamese War in the United States. So we have benefited a great deal, and maybe while we're throwing around all these biblical sayings about the meek shall inherit the earth, maybe our balancing act in Canada is pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jim Tagg, and thanks, Amy. It was very interesting. Is this on? As close as my social distance will allow. I'm just finishing the novel by Joseph Boyden, 3-Day Road, which is about Native Canadians who are in the First World War. Does conscription apply to native populations in Canada?
It didn't, no, because they weren't actually citizens. They were wards. They were considered underage children, basically. So a lot of Native Americans really wanted to join, but they weren't permitted to until fairly late in the war.
They were eventually permitted to, yes. They couldn't volunteer earlier in the war?
No, they really had to push and fight for it, which is sort of interesting that you mm-hmm. see various other groups as well. Blacks weren't permitted to enlist in the beginning, but a lot of these groups of Japanese Canadians weren't permitted. They really wanted to, and you would think that a society that did not allow you to do this wouldn't be one that you would consider worth fighting for, but we see an awful lot of efforts to try to show themselves worthy of fighting, and it seems to be sort of connected to the idea of citizenship, that if they went and they fought, maybe they'd be allowed to vote when they got back home and things like that. So, yeah.
As a follow-up to Eric Williams' questions, where was the least conscientious objection?
I didn't see very much in the Maritimes. I'm not sure exactly why. I'm not sure, and not very much in Quebec either. Maybe that's something that you were thinking of. I think in Quebec, possibly it was just easier to subsume it in the sort of political objection to the war that was going on there. It was probably a lot easier to simply default. A lot of people defaulted in the First World War. In the Maritimes, I'm not exactly sure. I'm sort of guessing that it's possibly the weaker presence of the historic peace churches there. There weren't very many Quakers or Mennonites there, possibly. A very strong Catholic presence, and there's a very strong sort of tradition of obedience to your church leaders there. I'm not sure exactly why, but yeah.
Okay. Thank you for a very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
That's very nice.
Hello, my name is Henning Lundell, and I'm going to give my question and then preamble to it. The question relates to whether the peace churches were given a similar, if I want, for lack of a better word, carte blanche mm-hmm. in terms of conscientious objection, and I'm talking specifically like the Mennonites mm-hmm. in World War II as they were in World War I. Mm-hmm. And the background to that I want to give is, I come from Germany, but from a Lutheran background, but I got to know quite a few Mennonites that came from Germany after the World War II. Mm-hmm. And they had a really rough time in their Mennonite communities mm-hmm. because it seemed in Canada, the Mennonites, they couldn't understand that some of these men had enlisted during the war. Well. Mm-hmm. They said, our choice, we are Mennonites like you, we are pacifists like you. Our choice was to be killed or to stay alive and be able to serve the Lord another day.
Yeah, no, I think the Second World War was a real challenge for a lot of Mennonite communities because... I'm going the wrong way there. I'm going to start somewhere else. But, in the Second World War, there was exemption for Mennonites, but it wasn't quite the same. It was certainly a more organized response on the part of the government. You could be exempted on the grounds of religion, which was much wider. You didn't have to be a historic peace church, but you had to go do something else, some sort of work of national importance. So you see them going off to lumber camps or building roads and things like that. So there was this effort to try to make sure people were still, you know, being useful and things like that. So, and it seems to be sort of similar numbers in the Second World War too. In terms of different groups, we see that in other ways. A bunch of Mennonites, that's a very specific number, a bunch, came to Canada from Russia in between the two wars as well. And they had not had exemption from military service in the First World War in Russia, so they had a little bit of experience. They had to fight. So when they came to Canada, and they weren't given the same exemption as their brethren were, because the Canada wasn't being as tolerant anymore after the First World War, they were sort of okay with it. It seemed like that they were more willing to accept alternative service, and so we see a real split in the Mennonite communities in the Second World War, and so I think that's sort of an interesting story there as well. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Erin Phillips. Amy, it was great, very interesting, and this actually leads into a question I had. I remember a friend saying that if you look at the roster of the United Churches in Southern Manitoba, most of the members are Weeps, Penners, Friesens. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, it's all the men, basically the men who fought in the Second World War were all shunned from their mm-hmm. churches. And so that's what built the United Church, because basically in southern Manitoba, you were either French Catholic or German Mennonite. Which leads me to my question, which is, if I remember correctly, J.S. Woodsworth got in big trouble with the Methodist Church for opposing the war.
He was sort of, well, he wasn't kicked out, I guess.
Well, he was
left.
Almost. I mean, yeah, he sort of made very unpopular and mm-hmm. sort of took himself out. What happened to people who chose to fight for conscientious objection status in mainline churches? Were they disciplined by their church bodies?
I haven't found any sort of specific reaction to individuals, but they were certainly ostracized. Ministers were expected to almost be like recruiting agents in their sermons, and you see interesting things when you go looking at church archives about circular letters sent around saying, in the Methodist Church, for example, can you please give us a list of the men in your congregation who are of age and haven't signed up, so we need to get at them, and you need to work with this. So it was a very difficult situation, and I think that's part of the reason why a lot of the people that we do see claiming conscientious objection in the First World War tend to be from certain religious groups, like ones that tended to rely more heavily on personal interpretation of the Bible and things like that, because they really had to go against all their other sort of religious authority, and it's mostly only for people who were accustomed to looking to other sources. Yeah.
I got here a little bit late, so I don't quite couldn't hear very well from there.
It was really good in the beginning.
But I think there's no such thing as non-existence.
Have your name, please.
There are two types of warfare: mm-hmm. the spiritual warfare and the physical warfare. Mm-hmm. The spiritual warfare started way back in history when the angel wanted to take God's place, and there was a fight on. It was a spiritual warfare. It's gone down through history. And I think I'm going to ask you a question on that, but we find that that was in Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14 where this warfare took place. And Jesus said, made an amazing statement: love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you. So he was really quite seemingly non-resistant. But Paul took on another way. He says, put on the whole armor of God and really fight. But it was a spiritual warfare. And I believe, I could ask you this question, don't you think if there was a more effective spiritual warfare, there would be less physical warfare today?
Oh, for certain, yeah. If people were better people, yeah, then you wouldn't have to resort to that. I think warfare is usually a sign of other sorts of failure.
I don't want to give the whole story.
No, we've got another questioner coming up here, please.
Huh?
We've got another questioner coming up here.
Yeah, good. I have found in my personal experience, too, I'm a professing Christian. I have worked in different churches in town here. But I find that when somebody opposes me, and I tell them I love you, and I still have a high regard for you, it's amazing how I disarm these people.
Thank you.
My name's Monica Mark. I wondered when you were talking, was there no place in the military where people who were conscientious objectors could work in non-combative areas like medical?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a certain amount of that, and you do see some people joining that way. Seventh-day Adventists, for example, they said that they were quite willing to join the military, provided that it was something that was helping, that was healing rather than fighting, and as long as they didn't have to do anything on their Sabbath, which was Saturday. So that's part of it. And you see other things going on. The Quakers set up a Friends Ambulance unit in Britain, in Great Britain, and a lot of Quakers from Canada went there to serve as stretcher bearers. But what seemed to be the problem for some people, the people who wouldn't accept non-combatant service, was that they didn't want to be under the position of obeying orders, and there seemed to be a general understanding that joining the military, they had to obey orders, and that they, if they were ordered to fight, they would have to fight. Like, there was non-combatant service was something of a misnomer. This seems to be a general understanding of the time. And furthermore, by the time conscription came around, they had enough people for the non-combatant stuff. What they really wanted was infantry. And so the Canadian government wasn't as willing to say, no, you can come and be a cook, because they had enough cooks. But so this was part of the problem as well.
Thank you. I appreciated your talk.
Thank you.
Well, that'll be it for the questions then. I want to thank Dr. Shaw for her presentation and response to questions, and let's give her a round of applause.